And Liguori is talking golf on Sunday morning with you, right here on The Fan.
Well, good morning, and welcome to Talking Golf on this Sunday, April 19th. Talking Golf with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Travelers Insurance. For auto, home, and business, Travelers, it's better under the umbrella. Well, how are you doing this morning? Hope you're hanging in there, staying positive, hopeful, and well. Remember to exercise. Walk, hike, go for a jog, do yoga, stretch, bike. And now New Yorkers can play golf again. All right. After shutting down courses on April 9th, the state reversed that decision and said golf courses could remain open with restrictions. So that's good news. Whatever you can do while maintaining social distancing to stay active, very important on a regular basis. You'll feel better physically and mentally. Well, this morning, I'll talk with both Seth Waugh, the CEO of the PGA of America, and best-selling author and golf columnist John Feinstein. Now, the PGA of America under Seth Waugh's leadership is made up of nearly 29,000 PGA professionals. And the organization hosts the PGA Championship, the Women's PGA Championship, the Senior PGA Championship, and the Ryder Cup. And I'm honored that Seth carved out a lot of time to talk with us this morning, so we'll get to that shortly. And then at around 7:40 or so, we'll catch up with John Feinstein. So we'll be back with Seth Waugh right after this. Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori, and it is my pleasure to welcome Seth Waugh to the show. Seth became the CEO of the PGA of America in September 2018, and the PGA of America is one of the world's largest sports organizations and serves over 29,000 PGA professionals. Hey, Seth, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be talking to you again.
First off, how I know. How are you and your family doing during this most challenging time?
You know, we're doing great, thanks. I'm a lucky guy. The days are obviously long and grindy as they are for everybody. They're kind of endless. You know, it's Groundhog's Day. They don't seem to have much of a beginning or an end. But we've got five children, and we've got a couple of refugees from New York City that are my goddaughter and a niece. And so every night after I finish up and come out of my cave, it's kind of a party. So it's everybody under the one roof, and you know, obviously this is an awful reason for it, but you know, you're really grateful for this kind of stolen, unexpected time with family. You know, it's all very simple, and there's no outside influences, and you kind of have big long dinners and movie nights and game nights, and we're at odds and evens to see who cleans up every night, and theme nights on Fridays. Tonight's Greek night, or last Friday was Greek night, excuse me, and you know, so it's really been one of the real magical only silver lining to this whole thing. But life is pretty good.
Right. I mean, family time is precious, but crazy, challenging times for sure. And I know you've solved a lot of problems and overcome many roadblocks in your previous life as head of Deutsche Bank Americas. And but boy, did you ever imagine something like this?
I don't think anybody did, you know, and as you say, good news, bad news is I've been through a few crises. I kind of lived through 9/11, where we lost a building that had 4,500 people in it in the tower collapse. And fortunately, we got everybody out before it collapsed. But, dealing with that and then the financial crisis and this one is so different in terms of the cure. In those cases, you're trying to build confidence and create activity and sort of, create an economy again. And this one, you know, the cure is kind of economic suicide, right? And shutting everything down, you just sort of hope we're not going to kill. It's obviously what we need to do. And I don't mean it's wrong. It's just you hope you don't kill the patient before you kill the disease. The pain that's being felt kind of everywhere with a shutdown. You know, there's no businesses that ever model their business with zero revenues for, you know, a quarter or two, right? And that's really what we're going through. So I applaud the government. They're they've done a lot of really, I think, clever and generous kind of things with the SBA loans and the CARES Act. And I think the moves, coordinated moves by the Federal Reserve have been sort of stunning in terms of their size and their breadth and their timing. And so, you know, we're lucky to live in a country where we have the means and the will to kind of get everybody to the other side of this thing. I mean, that's what has to happen, right? We just have to ride it out and hope everybody stays safe and healthy and that we have, you know, an economy on the other side of it. And I think it's all a question of how quickly that happens in terms of, you know, what the recovery looks like. If it takes, you know, 6 to 12 months, I think it's going to be a very deep, long recession. And if it's, you know, three or so months, I think we can have a fairly, you know, quick recovery. Feels like that recovery is going to be in fits and starts, and as it should be, come back slowly and allow, you know, things to open in partial ways and parts of the country open probably faster than others. So, you know, again, I think everybody's kind of doing what they're supposed to do, which is great. It's just, you know, how deep and how long. And I think that's what, you know, this uncertainty is a hard thing for everybody.
Well, I would certainly trust you and your background in finance. I mean, it's obviously well documented and very impressive. You were, as I mentioned, CEO of Deutsche Bank Americas. Before that, CEO of Quantitative Financial Strategies. You spent 11 years at Merrill Lynch. So how would you suggest our country get back economically, Seth? What would your ideas be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're doing, you know, the government is doing what they need to do. And I think the private sector is also stepping up. It's been, you know, a really, interesting public-private partnership. You know, if you look at what a number of companies are doing to try and sort of cure the PPE issues, and like Fanatics converting their, you know, their factories of T-shirts and hats into medical supplies, and B. Dratty in the golf space has done the same thing. And, you know, so there's, and all the best minds are on it. I think, you know, science is ultimately the fix here, right? We can get through this wave of it, but without some real vaccine at some point, which I'm certainly no expert, but it sounds like best case of that is first quarter of next year, and probably later than that in terms of how clinical trials have to go. But I think you could have a treatment before then, and I think ultimately, you know, I think people are willing to live their lives and take the risk of getting sick. I don't think they're willing to, you know, sort of, nor should they be, you know, run the risk of dying, right? And so I think, you know, some of the hope from this week has been the, you know, the clinical trials at Gilead and a few other companies that are starting to look like they're going to get on this. I've never seen America not, in the world in this case, not, you know, solve something that's solvable through science once you throw, you know, a wartime effort at it, which is what, you know, is going on here. And so, again, I think that the government is doing what they can. I think it's smart to try and keep people in their jobs. And I think, you know, creating these the cash in people's hands that need it. And I think, you know, a number of the charitable efforts that are already happening, I think that will continue to grow. And those that have can share with those that need. We all need to share the pain. I set the example the other day that, it's as if we're, you know, in a ship at sea and we all need to get to shore. And if we try to throw everybody in the lifeboat at once, we're probably all going to drown. But if we can, you know, kind of be calm and get the weak and the needy and the poor into those boats first and do a number of trips, we'll get everybody to shore. So that's how we've thought about it, is how do we get our, you know, the PGA of America first. It's a perpetual institution put on earth to serve our members, as you say, and grow the game, and I want to hand it off to the next generation in better shape than I found it. And so making sure that that survives, making sure our 41 sections around the country also, you know, get through to this other side, most of which are financially stable, but some might need a little bit of help. And then trying to figure out how to reach out to our members and do all we can to, you know, get them there. And we've kind of had a few thoughts on that. One is, you know, first of all, you know, trying to assist on the government programs and making sure everybody understands that in a way that that it, they should, and that, you know, these are first come, first serve kind of programs, and so getting them online to take advantage of what they can take advantage of. You know, we've got you know, golf is an $85 billion business with almost 2 million people in it, right? So it's not just a game. It's so much more.
Sure.
And it, you know, it's made up of a bunch of small businesses and a bunch of entrepreneurs and independent contractors in the form of our members, the PGA professionals. And, you know, they rely on obviously commerce and their, you know, the community of golf to kind of make a living. And so, we've delayed dues, national dues. Tax-wise, cannot cancel them. We would probably this year if we could, but not allowed. And now we've launched a golf emergency relief fund. We've funded that some savings and some of our reserves, and have put $5 million in cash into it, as well as $2.5 million, which we're hoping to match in the industry and other donors. And we're out now. We just launched yesterday, in fact, and we're out trying to raise around that and hopefully turn our $7.5 million into quite a bit more than that, right? So golf giving to golf. So it's a golf specific charity. It's relief.golf. If anyone out there wants to check it out, either as a potential beneficiary or perhaps even better as a donor, we'd appreciate it. And, you know, we hope that it becomes a fund that, you know, is going to aid the entire, you know, the golf industry in a way that, you know, as I said earlier, gets it to the other side. So we're trying to do everything we can think of to be good partners with everybody we're partners with and good stewards of the game. And a protector of all things golf, but, you know, certainly our members.
Sure. It's the Golf Emergency Release Fund. It's, you can go to relief.golf. And I know every member of the executive team voluntarily reduced their compensation, Seth. There have been personal donations from members of the board of directors and the other organizing you know, the PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour, USGA are just some of the industry organizations supporting this. And from what I hear, the site has just been overwhelmed that so many people in the golf business need help.
That's exactly right. We actually had trouble kind of processing everything a little bit yesterday. We've cleaned it all up. The third party you know, the servicer of the collector and distributor of the funds got a bit overwhelmed because of you know, the demand and need. We've slowed it down enough, and everyone we have kept it open for 24 hours. We have two phases of it, which is the initial phase, which will distribute checks sort of a short form, quick turnaround, sort of within 2 weeks, $500 to $1,500 cash out of our initial, you know, donation of $5 million, and then we'll start phase two in a week or so, week or two, when phase one wraps up, and we will that is a longer form. It'll sort of look to get to the most in need. That can raise you can have a grant up to $3,500 there, and so we're again trying to do get cash immediately in people's hands, and then deal with longer term problems as well on a go forward basis. And as you say, we have lots of entities with skin in the game. My whole team volunteered to give up a significant part of their compensation to directly to this. We thought that was the best way to be helpful and again share the pain. But then voluntarily, and very splattered by the fact that our officers and the board all stepped up to do similar donations. And so it's been very heartening. I actually was on CNBC on Friday. They asked me to come on and talk about it, and we've gotten a great response from golfers trying to help golf. I think a number of the tour players and the tour themselves will be very active in here. And I think it should be the golf charity, hopefully that's related to COVID, that really reaches the most people. And so we're proud of what we've tried to do here, and hope that we can turn it into a whole lot more. So thanks for your kind words.
Sure. We're talking to Seth Waugh, who is the CEO of the PGA of America, and the PGA Championship has been rescheduled from mid-May to August 6th through the 9th, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. And based on where our country is at the moment, Seth, how confident, say on a scale of 1 to 10, do you think that the PGA Championship will indeed take place in August?
If you said, will it take place in August, I'd be high. I'd be, an 8 or a 9. We think that it's, we want to do it in as normal way, but obviously a safe and a responsible way. That's number one. Obviously that'll be inviolate. We're not going to do anything that puts anybody in danger. We do think that the summertime, by most experts, say that there should be a kind of a lull, even if we don't have effective treatments at that point. With social distancing, with everything we're doing now, and with the warmer weather, that there should be a good period there to have more normalcy. We hope that it'll be, with fans. We certainly will plan to do that, but are not only willing but happy to do it without fans. We think, there is a pent-up demand for content and sports that needs to be fed. I think golf, offers a different sort of experience that may allow us to be the first sport back. You saw probably the PGA Tour announced their new schedule late last week. They're hoping to be playing in June, middle of June, more or less, with the first four tournaments without fans, and then hoping to add fans after that. So we will have some templates. We've been very coordinated with Jay Monahan and his whole team at the tour on protocols to make it as safe as we possibly can, both with and without fans. We've been in constant contact with the city of San Francisco, and they absolutely want to do this. On the other hand, we're not going to force anything. If that location doesn't feel that it's in the best interest of their city or their state, then we'll have a drop-dead date to try and sort out somewhere else in the country where we perhaps could hold it.
What would the drop date, the drop dead date be, do you think? As far as holding it in August?
Late spring, early summer, probably. Uh-huh. So we've got a month or two before that really needs to be decided. And we certainly want to do it in San Francisco. We haven't been there in over 25 years and to the West Coast. And we think, particularly from a TV perspective, it'll be prime time in the East Coast and prime viewing kind of around the country. We'll be the first major out, which will be a role reversal. We used to be the fourth major until we moved to May last year and became the second one. And so we're happy to try to lead the charge to do it. So I think we have an excellent chance of getting golf in this summer if I think we have a particularly excellent chance of hopefully getting our championship done. and then, you know, have a FedEx Cup for the tour and U.S. Open at Wingfoot in September, and then hopefully our Ryder Cup the week after. And so there will be a lot of pent-up demand, but there'll be a rush of for all of us, you know, golf junkies. There's going to be a lot to watch between sort of, you know, July and finishing up with the Masters in November.
So if all it's all going to come down to August, September, October, November. But as you had said earlier, a PGA Championship without fans is still better than no PGA Championship at all. But, you know, when you're talking about no spectators, if that tends to be, if that's going to be the case, you know, volunteers are there, the staff is there, players, caddies, the media. So are you confident that the PGA of America could pull off a major championship, protecting those who are there if, you know, the general public is not going to go?
The answer is we've got some work to do between now and August, but yes. We've talked to health experts. We're in constant contact with them in a variety of forms. Again, we've been coordinated with the tour. We have estimated that it will be somewhere between, 1,000 to 1,500 people that would be needed, you know, from a media perspective, plus, as you say, volunteers, scoring rules, players, caddies. You're still, it's a lot of people. But you're talking about over 200 or 300 acres. You can, have a natural distancing. There's no forced contact between anybody. There's ways to not have public indoor spaces, have everything spaced outdoors, put ways to stage have what time people arrive at the course. So, I'm making it up, but, let's say the television crew arrives at 7 a.m. And then, players start arriving at, 8 and officials at 9. And, so you don't have crowds waiting in gathering. We believe there will be adequate testing at that point and fast testing such that you could test everybody, say, a week before and a day before, and you could keep people in a relatively controlled space during that, week of competition or 4 days of practice round, 2 days of practice round and 4 days of competition. We absolutely believe that it's possible, and as do, more importantly, as do the health experts that we're talking to. So we believe it's 100% possible, and we just have to make sure that area is not a hot spot or not a scary spot, if you will, at that point in time, right?
Right. I know the governor of California had said that the possibility of having mass gatherings in California before September is, quote, unlikely. So, but you say San Francisco is welcoming, yeah, really wants to host August 6th through 9th. That's not too far away.
Yeah. No. Well, it used to seem a long way away, and now it seems awfully close, right? But I think again, a mass gathering of could be defined as 200 people in a crowded restaurant, right? But if you talk about 1,000 people over 300 acres, that may not be a mass gathering if you can handle it properly, right? Now, obviously, we have to walk them through all the plans. They have to get comfortable with that, we're going to be the best possible partner, but we're going to be, the smartest we can be about how to do it safely and responsible. We're certainly not going to force anything. If California is uncomfortable or the city of San Francisco is uncomfortable, then we're not going to do it. And if we're uncomfortable because, we don't think we can manage it in a way that isn't going to put anybody at risk, then we're not going to do it. And so, all intention is to do it. Because again, we think it's a sort of hopefully a ray of hope for people. It's a distraction. The players certainly want to play, and TV wants to show, and we want to crown a champion. And so, we're going to do the best we can to, to pull it off without, you know, again, by being smart. I've said, you know, having lived through a few of these crises, and they're all different. I mean, the, you know, you have to, I think, do two things. You have to have a, you know, you have to be smart, and more importantly, you have to be human. And if you can kind of think about it that way, you know, how is safety first going to lead the way rather than, you know, profit and loss or any other, you know, sort of measurement. And that's the safety of your own people and your partners and everybody around you. And if you can do that and do it intelligently, then, you know, you've sort of shown the world that you have both a brain, but also a soul. And that's what creates lasting institutions in my mind. And that's how you come out of a crisis, you know, sort of stronger, more united, you know, better aligned with your partners, and better understood, because people are going to watch you and understand kind of who you are by how you, you know, what you do, but as or more importantly, you know, how you behave, right? And that's how we're going to approach everything we do. That's how we ended up with a relief fund, and that's how we're going to approach, you know, our championships. We're going to do them in a way that is the most responsible, the safest. But you know, we're gonna try to have a yes rather than a no if it's possible to do it in given those parameters.
Sure. And would you consider moving the date, even pushing it later in the year if need be?
I think that will end up being very difficult. You know, we worked as an industry very hard to. And the tour and Jay were unbelievable about, you know, accommodating not only his events, but all the trying to have all four majors and a Ryder Cup in, you know, a half a season effectively, or, you know, whatever it'll end up being, two thirds of a season. So the thought that we could reshuffle again, I think is very hard. And so, I do think at this point things are locked in. If we miss our date, we miss our date, and that's obviously very disappointing. But I don't think you can kind of put Humpty Dumpty back again for another time, right? I'm proud of what we did. I'm proud of, you know, Jay and how he orchestrated a lot of this to, you know, be fair to every golf body. And you know, now it's a bit of, as you say, luck of the draw. If August ends up being a great month and November for some reason doesn't, you know, we'll have gotten lucky and Augusta won't have. And, you know, we all accept that.
Right, right. Well, I can imagine a PGA Championship with no spectators, if that's what it comes down to, Seth, in August. But I can't imagine a Ryder Cup without fans. And would the PGA of America host a Ryder Cup without spectators? I know it's September 25th through the 27th, Kohler, Wisconsin, Whistling Straits. Have you thought about, I'm sure you thought about it, could they do a Ryder Cup without spectators?
Well, I think, you know, if you've ever been to one, which you probably have, Ann, sure. They're pretty unique, right? And they are, you know, the fans are the Ryder Cup to a certain degree. And you're right to ask the question. You know, that moment on the first tee, and the, you know, it's ironically the first shot on the first day is rather than the final putt on the final day is kind of the moment of the championship, given, you know, how tribal it is and how the fans get into it. And so it is hard to imagine one without fans. You know, we have begun to talk about whether you could create some virtual fan experience, and we're going to try to be as creative as we can, and we'll talk to our partners. Obviously, we have a partner in the European Tour, a great partner in the European Tour. Our partners, you know, in every at the PGA Tour and elsewhere, and you know, we'll make the best decision we can about that. But you know, whether to be determined, frankly, whether you know you'd hold it without fans or not. Do you think it? It is different than, you know, every other. They're all special, and all of them are obviously, you know, fan experiences and better with fans. And I'm not suggesting it doesn't change the experience, but in the Ryder Cup, it's particularly important. And so we will be very careful about that. It's a very unique thing. I think if we can pull it off this year, it would be an amazing exclamation point to the year, particularly without the Olympics happening. I think it, and to a certain degree, replaces the Olympics in some ways in terms of, the international, sort of patriotism and emotion that comes with the whole thing. And it would be an amazing moment, I think, not only for the game, but for, the whole sports world if we can pull it off with fans. And so that's certainly our hope. That's our plan. And if that gets derailed, we'll, I'll come back on your show.
Last question, Seth, because I know you're very busy and I so appreciate your time. How overwhelming has all this been for you? I mean, there's so much fear out there, uncertainty, grief. I would imagine it just has to be so difficult to be a leader of a major organization. Do you have sleepless nights? Is there any kind of fear factor? How are you dealing with it, knowing that you're leading this huge sports organization that affects so many people?
Well, you're nice to ask. The good news and the bad news, again, is that I've lived through a few of them. The two biggest being 9/11, certainly, which was, unimaginable, and then the financial crisis and a few others that felt very serious at the time, but look sort of more minor in retrospect. The answer is you don't think about it. You're sort of in the middle of something. People are counting on you. You get up in the morning and do the best you can, and again have a brain and a soul at every decision that you make. You try to be as patient as you can be, as calm as you can be, and as thoughtful as you can be. I try to start the day with, okay, how do we survive? What is my immediate responsibility, and how do I make sure that that I'm doing everything I can within, my job to make sure that, my shareholders are in this case, stakeholders, that I'm satisfying everything I can for them. The next part of the day, I kind of think about, okay, how can I help in any way I can to get everybody through this thing? And certainly everybody in our own sphere, but, I've been around for a while, so we're all connecting with different industries and getting calls from, the White House and from, various government officials and industry contacts and outside the industry to kind of share ideas and connect dots for people. And then you start thinking about, okay, well, what's the future? How do we come out of this thing smarter, better? None of us are going to come out of it, financially as intact as we went into it, but you can set yourself up for being that much better for the next, decade. I think if you think about it in those buckets, there's always, hopefulness. This thing will end. We will come out the other side. There's a question about that. I have total faith in the country to do that and the world to do that. And as I said earlier, science to figure something out, that's when it's truly over, right? And when we have a vaccine and a treatment, that's when it will truly be over, and that will be for a while. But the key is, how do we make sure to get as many people to that point when it's truly over that we possibly can? And we all owe it to our, each other and to, being a good citizen and a good leader to do that in every way we can. I try to call four or five people that I may not have talked to in a while, just to see how they're doing, kind of every day. Either, reach out to some form and check on them, make sure. And there's, as I started out saying, there's some beauty going on here too, which is to remind us all about what's really important and the simple parts of life and how we've lost that as we've gotten so busy. I said to somebody the other day, it's Little House on the Prairie with internet, right? We're not, we're staying at home. Television barely goes on. We're, we're talking more than we ever have. We've had three meals a day, more or less with my entire family for, 5 weeks in a row now. That just doesn't happen. And so making sure you take advantage of this time, maybe there's some long-term goal you had, you're going to get in better shape, you're going to write a book, you're going to learn to play the piano or whatever it is, you know, you're not going to get this time back. And so just writing it off, I think, is a major mistake as well. And I think the right way to get through it is by, you know, helping. And that's going to make you not only, you know, it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do, and it's going to make you feel better about yourself, right?
Seth, I appreciate your time. Cherish the time that you have with your family. We so appreciate the hope and knowledge and inspiration you provide to the golf industry. I can't thank you enough. Again, the website is relief.golf, the Golf Emergency Relief Fund, and I hope to see you soon. Thank you so much for being on Talking Golf.
Thanks for all you do. And good luck to everybody out there. Be smart and stay safe.
Thanks so much. Seth Waugh, the CEO of the PGA of America.
It's Sunday morning, and you're talking golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Well, welcome back to Talking Golf. How are we doing this morning? Boy, Seth Waugh, he was incredible. He was just gave us so much material, and you know, he remains hopeful that the PGA of America will be played in August in San Francisco with or without spectators. You know, he said that if the pandemic prevents the PGA Championship from taking place in August, that if they miss their date, they could not reschedule. And you know, when would he reschedule? I mean, there's just the calendar is just crammed. Give us a call here at 877-337-6666. We'll get your comments on Seth Waugh and whatever you want to talk about. 877-337-6666. Seth and I also talked about the Ryder Cup, and I asked him about the possibility of having a Ryder Cup with no fans, and you know, he agreed it's hard to imagine a Ryder Cup without fans. But he said they have begun to talk about the possibility of creating some kind of virtual experience. So that's interesting. He said it's hard to imagine one without fans. We have started talking about whether you could create some virtual fan experience. He said we will try to be as creative as we can. And of course, they're working with their partners, the European Tour, the PGA Tour, and everybody else. But he said we'll make the best decision about it, you know, at the right time. Let's go to the phones here at 877-337-6666. Frank from Connecticut, you're on The Fan. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Ann. How you doing?
Good, 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 good. Just had a long chat with Seth Waugh, the PGA of America CEO, and boy, he loves to talk. I love it.
Yeah, we have him on our show once in a while. He's been a friend of mine for a long time, and you know, he's our boss at the PGA, and he's great. He's got a lot of vision, and I look forward to the future with him.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you talk about these leaders of these governing bodies in golf. They have so much responsibility as it is, and particularly at this time, you know, this time of crisis, Frank. And I know you're a PGA member and you host a show on PGA Tour Sirius Radio. What are you hearing from the other pros out there? I know the website that they put up to help members of the PGA was just so overwhelmed that I think after like 24 hours, they took phase one down of this, you know, site. So it's just been, I'm sure there's tons of people out there that are really in need right now.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. You know, the PGA didn't realize how many people would be calling in. Susie Whaley, our president, came back on that night and just, you know, talked about the issues that they had with the overwhelming amount of people. So it's back on track and they've extended things. And, you know, the Susie and Seth and the PGA board they always try to do the right thing. So, you know, I was fine with everything that happened.
What are you hearing from some of your fellow pros out there in the New York metropolitan area?
I think they're hurting quite a bit, and they're trying to go online and try to sell their merchandise. And, you know, I think just the air of uncertainty is, you know, causing people to just pause. And, you know, I know the clubs are coming back on, but there's not going to be any employees there. And, you know, let's hope we have a chance to, you know, have two or three good months of, you know, tournaments and, you know, members having a great time and at their clubs.
Right. Well, you know, you called the show, like, what, the 2 weeks ago, and New Yorkers were playing golf, and people in Connecticut were playing golf, and then on April 9th, the governor shut the golf courses down in New York, and just recently, they have reversed that decision and said that golf courses could remain open with restrictions, Frank. What do you think about that?
You know, as long as we've missed playing golf and being there, I think that we need to kind of be a little bit more cautious and maybe wait another week until things really start to go down a little bit. I mean, I thought it was kind of ridiculous with the beaches being open in Florida yesterday and people not abiding by the social distance. I know people want to get out and play golf, but we've been in this long enough. Let's just be a little bit more patient and make sure that it doesn't come back at us.
Exactly. Well, John Feinstein is, I think, standing by. And John Feinstein, good morning. Welcome to Talkin' Golf.
Good morning, Ann. I'm so sorry that I'm so late. It's a long, boring story. We had a brownout in our house and screwed up the phones, and I apologize. Good to be with you.
Oh, wow. Well, good to be with you. We don't have much time, but we'll get right into it. So 42 books, 29 nonfiction. It just seems like, John, you're on this accelerated pace lately as far as writing.
Well, I've probably been on an accelerated pace all my life, Ann, just because I love to do what I do. I'm like you. I'm very lucky that I get paid to do things most people would pay to do, and have enjoyed, you know, every job has its down moments, but I've enjoyed most of the ride for a long, long time now.
Exactly. And we'll talk about your latest in a few, but you know, Seth Waugh came on with me in the first half of the show, and he said he remains hopeful that the PGA of America will be able to be played in August with or without spectators. But he also said that if they somehow have to miss that date, then it will not be rescheduled. So I just wanted to know your opinions on that and, you know, this very aggressive revised PGA Tour schedule.
Well, I think that's the aggressive is the right word. And the word Seth Waugh used, hopeful, is the best you can hope for at this point. We don't know. None of us knows day to day how long this is going to go on, what it's going to be like when things begin to loosen up. They have not yet begun to loosen up. And I think that there's a chance that we won't see any more golf all year. There's a chance we won't see football this year. Or we'll see golf and football, maybe best case scenario, baseball too, in empty stadiums. It's going to be very difficult to figure out how to do these things. And I do know, because I've been working on a piece for the USGA Journal on this, that Seth Waugh, Mike Davis from the USGA, Fred Ridley from Augusta National, Martin Slumbers from the RNA, Jay Monahan from the PGA Tour, and Mike Wan from the LPGA Tour have been on the phone with one another almost nonstop since March 12th when everything shut down. And they've been discussing all the possible scenarios, best case, worst case, and put together, I think, what you and Seth Waugh described accurately as a hopeful schedule. Whether it'll come off, I wouldn't even want to put odds on it, Ann, because we just don't know.
Exactly. It's so hard to tell. So much uncertainty. But the tour plans to resume play with the first four events closed to the general public, and the first one will be the Charles Schwab Challenge in June 8th through the 14th in Texas.
Known to most golf fans as the Colonial.
Right, the Colonial, exactly. And then the RBC Heritage, then the Travelers. Right. Love the Travelers Championship, June 22nd to the 28th, and that will be a TV-only event, which is, you know, you get a tournament like that, which is has won all kinds of awards, so fan-friendly, and to put on an event like that without spectators, yeah, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, you know, the Travelers has been one of the tournaments I go to every year because it's not that hard to get to and because they do such a great job with it for everybody, fans, media, TV, the players love it. That's why they've gotten such remarkable fields the last few years, even though it's the week, it used to be the week after the U.S. Open. And the thought of walking around there with no one there other than players, caddies, and officials is eerie. But this whole experience has been eerie. And we've got a lot more of it ahead of us. We just don't know. I mean, I've been talking to basketball coaches in the last couple weeks, and they're being told by their schools there's a good chance the season won't start till January, because if you don't have students in school in the fall, how can you play sports? And so it's really an odd situation. And again, I think the tour might be getting ahead of itself a little bit by saying they're going to come back June 11th. That feels like a long way away on the one hand, on April 19th, but it also feels awfully close given the current circumstances.
John, we have like 2 minutes left, and I know you wrote you wrote a piece on Doug Sanders, the peacock of the fairways. He was your very first golf interview.
He was. When I was in college, as a college junior, I went to the Greater Greensboro Open and working for the student newspaper at Duke. And I had followed Doug Sanders since I was a kid when I first started following golf. Arnold Palmer was my hero, like with everybody else. But I knew what a good player he was. His swing was unique. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe I'll see if I can talk to him. And I walked up to him after he played the third round, introduced myself, and said, could you talk for a few minutes? And he said, yeah, come on inside. I'll buy you a beer. And we sat at the bar. I was underage, and he bought me about four beers and gave me enough material for about three columns. I mean, he was terrific. To a kid, you know, to somebody who was no one. And I always remember that. And I also remembering that years and years later at the Masters, standing inside the ropes there under the tree, the way we all gather, I looked and saw Doug Sanders trying to get inside the ropes. He didn't have a credential to get inside the ropes. This is a guy who won 20 times on the PGA Tour and just missed winning four majors. Everybody remembers the missed putt at the British Open, the three-footer that would have won, but he was second by one shot or losing in a playoff four times. A great player, arguably a Hall of Fame player, and never got the credit he was due, in my mind, by the powers that be in golf.
I agree. He seemed to always be on the outside looking in. John, well, thanks for coming on. You'll have to come on.
Sorry to come on so late, Ann. Thanks for having me. We'll do it
again. All right. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you soon. I just have great memories of Doug Sanders. My friend Buddy Sklar and Doug Sanders were great friends, and Buddy was a member of the Madison Club and Tradition in La Quinta. And every time I visited the desert, I played golf with Buddy, and Doug would join us. And he just was so lovely and told great stories. And anyway, the last time I saw Doug Sanders was at Arnold Palmer's memorial service in La Trobe. And he's just such a lovely guy. All right, well, that's it. Thanks to John Feinstein, Seth Waugh, Brian Roscona in the studio. Thanks to you. And Talking Golf with Ann LaGoria was brought to you by Travelers Insurance for auto, home, and business. Travelers, it's better under the umbrella. Follow me on Twitter at Ann LaGoria, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram at The Ann LaGoria. Next Sunday, the legendary Gary Player will join us. Stay well, stay safe. I'll catch up to you, with you, next Sunday morning. Rick Wolf's Sports Edge is up next. And have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you next Sunday morning on Talkin' Golf with Ann LaGoria.
Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66. The Fan!